Good morning, it's Davey O'Reilly here with you between now and 1 o'clock. Hands up, I have to admit I'm one of those grouchy people that just never does the whole countdown thing. You can find me asleep at midnight on the 31st of December in any given year. The same was sort of the case this week as well, because I'm sort of one of these that says, what's the difference between the 31st of December and the 1st of January? Grouchy, I do know, but waking up yesterday morning, the continuing realisation that COVID-19 doesn't know what year it is either, wishing anybody a happy new year, it seems rather hollow, a hollow greeting right now. We kind of banded it up in the office this morning. Maybe we could be better off saying something like hopeful new year for the next few weeks anyway, because for so many people, there's damn all to be happy about yesterday, today, this weekend, next week or over the next few weeks. And there hasn't been an awful lot to be happy about over the last year. And we wished each other a happy new year 12 months ago and we see how that worked. But there certainly is hope. There's no doubt about that. And I think looking at the papers, there's a lovely photograph on the front of the Irish Times. New year, new dawn. And the picture really does, I suppose, encapsulate what we're going through right now. There's shadows there. But it's a lovely photograph there. Visitors on top of the Hill of Tara in County Meath enjoy the first sunrise of 2021. This part of County Meath has long been associated as a place to mark the departure of the old and the rebirth of the new. So that's what we're hoping for over the next few weeks. But then there's no getting away from where we are on the front of the Irish Times today. Gap between vaccine doses may be extended to accelerate inoculations. So this is what's happening in the UK as well. They're spreading out the time between the first and second doses, because that's what's needed. And it might allow for the opportunity maybe to roll it out further across the areas that are needed. And Dr. Tony O'Houlihan, he's asking if that is possible here, if anything can be done to try and help the situation that we're in at the moment with this warning that there's another maybe 9,000 cases in the system to be revealed to us over the next few days, that it's run rampant. We're in a mitigation scenario now. It really is not getting any better on that front. And certainly this third wave seems more scary than the first one we had, and indeed the one we had back in November. The Irish Examiner has creche opening delayed by virus spikes. Record of 1,754 COVID-19 infections. So yesterday was another record. And back to the Irish Times, by the way. They have an awful lot of coverage inside on COVID and where we are and questions answered. But if you want I suppose, read something a little funnier, Miriam Lord has her look at the year ahead. It's a wry look at the political year ahead. So if you want a good laugh or something to liven up your Saturday on the 2nd of January, yes, it is the 2nd of January, yes, it is Saturday, Miriam Lord is always on a winner there in the Irish Times. Now, the Irish Independent: nursing home vaccinations threatened by the surge in cases. That's because there are 53 open outbreaks in nursing homes around the country, and there may be a difficulty in getting the vaccinations and getting the vaccines into nursing homes where there are outbreaks. Now, on the Irish Mail, they go with a completely different story, as does the Irish Daily Mirror. And it is a fury at God is a Rapist RTE clip. Church and state officials condemn the sketch, a comedy sketch broadcast on RTE on New Year's Eve, which depicted God as a rapist, has sparked a furious backlash. So this was the programme welcoming in the new year, and there was a skit which a lot of people didn't find very funny at all, including the Archbishop of Armagh, Eamon Martin, who tweeted about it yesterday, and I suppose is looking for some sort of a response or an apology from RTE. The Irish Daily Mirror, their heading is God Awful RTE, Church and Viewers Erupt in Fury at Show Depicting Almighty as a Rapist at Court. So if Joe Durfee is wondering how he's going to fill his programme on Monday, Joe, you'll have no problem. That's definitely for sure. That is a story I'm sure we'll be hearing a little bit more of. Now, I'm going to go back to the Irish Times, because in their weekend review, as you've been hearing in an ad there in the lead up to the news, there is an interview and a piece with John Clark reflecting on his life and times with his late wife, Marion Finucane. And it's Marion and Me, and he's been speaking to Cathy Sheridan. And there is a certain poignancy sitting here today, because it is January the 2nd, And it's the first anniversary of the death of Marion Finucane, who literally invented and developed this slot into one of the most listened to radio programmes in the country over the last 14 or 15 years. Now, her friends, the filmmakers Patrick Farley and Kate O'Callaghan, have spent the last year making a wonderful, insightful documentary about Marion's life, but also about the grief of her widower, John Clark. And it's through the eyes of John that Marion's story is told, and it's being aired on RTE1 television at 9:30 on Monday evening next. And Patrick and Kate are here with me. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Damien.
Lovely to see you, Patrick, and you, Kate, as well. Patrick, I'll start with you first. Intimate is the word I'd use for this documentary. It's Marion, as I said, through the eyes of her beloved husband and partner for over 40 years, John Clark, as he tries to find a way of coping with the loss of Marion. And we're going to talk about that presently. But how did you know Marion and John?
Well, I started working with Marion when I first came out. I was out of college in the late 70s, which is a very long time ago. And I got a job as a researcher on a summer show that featured two novices. The presenter was a guy called Pat Kenny, who had never presented a current affairs show before. And the main reporter was Marion Finucane, who had worked in continuity. And I was a researcher. I didn't know anything either. But we were brought in by Dermot Peavoy and Eugene Murray. And it was a summer show, 78. And I basically was a researcher. So I ended up working with Marion a lot. And we were all kind of new and young, and we were really kind of, we weren't jaded or cynical, and we just wanted to do new stuff. So I ended up doing a lot of like research that ended up pieces that Marion ended up reporting on. And she was just such an extraordinary woman to work with. I mean, like even at that point, she would go anywhere, do anything, you know, utterly open, not a hint of cynicism of any kind. So for me, being young, she was an extraordinary kind of person to work with.
Did you spot her unique talent at that early stage in terms of the way she went about her business of reporting for Pat Kenny and for that show? She wasn't going through the motions. She was always looking for a different angle.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about her is that, like, once you met her, first of all, and then you actually saw her in action as a reporter, and then you heard her material, you knew you were dealing with somebody different. You knew you had, she had a spark that was kind of, you know, that you were immediately drawn to. So, and I think it was noted over that summer at just how good she was, how different she was. So I think that when about a year later, RTE decided to put on, you know, what was a kind of a revolutionary move on their part, a program called Women Today. She really was the obvious person to present it.
Mm. Because she didn't go for the spokesperson or the authority. She went for the subject in terms of if there was a story about, we'll say, the increase in bank robberies, which people remember around, was it the late 70s, early 80s of businesses. And she, in the programme meeting, came up with the interview idea, which actually was followed through on, which nobody else probably at the time would have thought about.
Yeah, I remember like looking around and you know, when Marion brought it up, and then kind of saying, well, I actually think I might be able to kind of set something like that up. And then the next thing, myself and Marion were in a back room of a pub just off Sean McDermott Street with a couple of guys who were actual bank robbers. And
so while everybody else was saying, well, we should interview the guards, we should interview politicians, she said, why don't we interview a bank robber?
Exactly, because they're the guys who are doing it, and that was the big problem. So let's figure out like where they're coming from. And I'm not sure that if I had been working in RTE at that time and I was working with almost anybody else I can think of, I don't think there would have been the same kind of level of openness and enthusiasm on Marion's part. And as I remember at the time, she basically gave them the same kind of interview that she would give to, you know, a politician or a clergyman or whoever, you know. I mean, it would be open, but it would also, she asked the tough questions as well.
It's amazing you should say that, because Archbishop Diarmaid Martin was on the Sean O'Rourke show, which ironically enough, I ended up presenting on the 3rd of January, the day after Marian's death, and we obviously put the programme together very much last minute. And the one thing he said, that whenever he was interviewed by Marian, he always felt that she showed him the same respect as everybody else, that that was one thing that he noted about her, was the sense of respect that she showed everybody without prejudice.
Absolutely. And also one of the other items that we did, which caused ructions when we did it, was, again, you know, we ended up doing a thing on you know, sex workers, prostitutes as they were called then. And, you know, Marian went down, she met the women, you know, and for the first time, really, on RT Radio, a piece was completely dominated by the voices of the women who were actually there on the street and who ended up in that situation. And, you know, and they also kind of like what caused ructions. They made allegations that, in fact, some of them were being arrested and some of them weren't. And the reason why some of them were being arrested was that they weren't providing what they said were sex and information to the guards. And that caused a huge, huge eruption. But for Marian, it was the authenticity of their voices.
Yeah.
And it was something, of course, which later on Women Today became, you know, much more part of her public kind of presence, so to speak.
And we do hear some of that archive in the documentary, which we'll talk about in a moment. But Kate, how did you get to know Marian?
Well, I came a little later to Features and Current Affairs. I think it was the 80s. By the time I got here, I came to work as a researcher. And by then, Marian had moved on to, we worked on Saturday View with her. So even then, you know, she was, I think women's issues had moved on and she had begun, they hadn't totally, obviously, but she'd begun to get interested in other areas of you know, life, and she never lost that curiosity. So I started then.
Yeah, as John says in the documentary, she very much loved being part of the national discussion. And that was probably the way it was back then. But not only were you both colleagues, Kate, you became friends, lifelong friends.
We were friends over the years. Yeah, we actually started our relationship on that show, Patrick and myself. So,
and you're still together.
Yeah. We're still together.
Where all great love stories begin.
Indeed.
In this dark building for a lot of cases.
But to go back to Marian and John, I don't think that I think they had one of the best relationships of anybody I've ever known. That they were constantly, you know, talking to each other. Even if you stayed there at night, you'd hear them chatting away, you know.
And I think you must be happy with the way that is reflected in this documentary.
Yeah, John is really wonderful at telling that story, I think. I mean, I think one of the ways it came about was that we ended up being here in Ireland and we'd been to see John in March. And there was something about him that you know, he was trying to deal with his grief. And it reminded us of a book by, you know, that American writer Joan Didion. Mm-hmm. And she wrote a book about the death of her husband, John Gregory Dunn, called The Year of Magical Thinking. He dropped dead at the table just like that. It died very suddenly. And there was something about John's grief that really, you know, Patrick and myself began to think he would be really good at telling that story. And obviously he's incredibly articulate.
Yeah. Because you say you were here, you missed her funeral. You've been living, Patrick, in the States. Is that right, both of you?
Yeah, well, we left RT and moved to New York in the, you know, at the beginning of 1984, ended up doing journalism, and then we ended up actually being producers with Michael Moore, he of Fahrenheit 9/11 fame. We were producers of his television, satirical political television shows, the TV Nation and The Awful Truth. But, you know, then we started doing a bit more work back in Ireland. And, you know, I think we actually did end up making a feature documentary with Marian that she also co-produced and presented back in 2011, which was about the life of Nuala O'Fualon. And, you know, I think in some ways, some of the themes in that documentary, you know, had really a kind of like bittersweet echoes for us in terms of making this one.
Right.
You know, because a lot of stuff about like, you know, well, you know, debt and life. And
their lives were so interwoven as well, which is very much part of this. So, Kate, you as I said, you arrived here and then obviously COVID struck and you found yourself still here and you were visiting John as a friend. But I mean, there is the journalistic, I suppose, earwig in the back of your mind thinking, you know, I wonder, should we ask John, would he like to talk? I mean, was it difficult? Did you feel, you know, that he was up for it? How did you approach the idea of asking John to go on TV and talk very intimately about his wife, who he, I get the impression, is still not over the grief?
No, of course, absolutely not. I mean, as everything with John, he's very straightforward. He tells you very directly, you know, he's not a man to beat around the bush. So we just asked him whether he, you know, how he felt about it. And he said, yes. I mean, I think he felt that he'd prefer to do it with us in the sense that we were friends and he trusted us. So, yeah, he was very open. I mean, open within limits, and he knew that we would, you know, go with him along the way. So we did. I remember we were talking about it and whether it would just be him, you know, whether we could just carry, whether he would carry the documentary. And we thought it was a more interesting way to do it than just to do the regular, you know, all the people talking.
Because people will see it on Monday. It is John shot, by the way, Patrick, can you explain this? Shot in black and white, very raw, very, very raw, very intimate. I think the picture on the front of the Weekend Review in the Irish Times captures exactly the way we will see him on TV on Monday. And he narrates us through his life with Marion, telling us about her in ways that we never, ever heard before, because Marion was immensely private, as you know, and we have access to photographs of their happy times together. I'm just wondering, just a follow-on to the question I put to Kate. Obviously, as filmmakers, you're saying, OK, this is something we'd like to do. This will be really good. But on the other hand, as a friend of John's, was there that thin line between having this unique slim window of getting John at this crucial time to talk about Marion and also making sure that you weren't exploiting a situation that he is in at the moment where he is still trying to find how to cope with her passing?
You've summed up all of the issues that we were facing. But I think that one of the things that really that myself and Kate and John were united on is that, and John was very specific about it. He was basically saying, listen, the last thing that Marion would have wanted would have been some kind of cut and paste. Wasn't she a wonderful woman? Sort of like, you know, picture of, she would have just been incredibly embarrassed by that. So like, so we basically approached it as, you know, basically telling a very, very real story and telling a story of a relationship. But also because John wasn't just her husband, he was somebody who was always encouraging her, who, you know, when Marion had any issues or whatever, he was incredibly supportive and also could be critical as well. So they had that extraordinary relationship. And we wanted to just, on the one hand, capture an extraordinary love affair at one level, and at another level, take people on a journey through her career. Because the thing about it is that, you know, one of the things about the documentary is we deal with her early career a lot. And the reason, in many ways, we wanted to do that is because, you know, it's 40 years ago. So in other words, for anybody under the age of 60, wouldn't have been familiar with you know, Marion's beginnings and the extraordinary groundbreaking work she did at the time, and which really kind of shaped a lot of the rest of her life. So we wanted to kind of tell that story as well. But I think in a way, when we started, like myself and Kate sat down with Kate McCullough, who's this terrific cinematographer who we worked with on the new Lo Fuelon documentary. And, you know, one of the things that I don't get the Kates mixed up is that Kate O'Callaghan, she'd seen this photograph by John Minahan of Sam Beckett, with this black and white photograph, and the side of his face looks like the side of a cliff. And it kind of reminded us of John a lot. And then Kate McCullough, picking up on that, said, you know, we should just shoot this in black and white, because the thing about John is he's so compelling that if you shoot it in black and white and the rest of the documentary is in the various different forms it'll come in with archive over the years, you're in John's zone. And, you know, whenever you come back to him, you know you're coming back and you're being rooted in his story and in who he is. And I think that, you know, we think it works very, very well.
And there is that Beckett-esque pose in a way, isn't there? And the rawness of John smoking a cigarette. Like, I suppose people that have suffered grief, particularly people that have lost a partner late in life, a soulmate, I think when they sit down and watch this, they will see their own grief playing out through John's thoughts and the way he speaks so lovingly of Marion. Do you think it was important for him, Kate, to do this?
I think he really wanted to do justice to Marion, very, 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 very much so. And I think he does, you know. I think also John, you know, had dealt with grief. They had lost their daughter, Sinead. So they'd been through so much. And that kind of solidified their relationship in many ways, even though often a death like that actually splits people in relationships. But with them, it drew them closer together.
Yeah, because the irony is that in shooting it in black and white, John's phrase and the way he remembered Marion was that she made colours brighter.
Yeah.
Yeah, very much so. And you know, it was, but I do think that it kind of roots you in it. And luckily, like, you know, Orty and our commissioning editor here, Grainne McAleer, were very, very supportive of what we were doing, and even though it was a kind of an unusual approach. But I think, though, that, you know, he's somebody who actually almost has an old-fashioned way of using English. It's a very old Dublin way of talking that he has. You know, one of the things when John saw himself for the first time, apart from the fact he said, God, I look so old, was that he said, I sound so Dublin. And it is a very old, kind of almost like a traditional Dublin way of sentence structure and of talking, you know.
And he is the subject here. Obviously, the programme is called Marion, but it's as I said at the beginning, it is John's story. Who is John Clark?
I mean, I think as he describes himself, I mean, he was a guy who was married before and had children before he met Marion, as Marion was married as well. But he was somebody who was a very unusual man in the sense that he was incredibly literate and well-read, I mean, and both of them were. But he was also started off in one of the, I think, the first advertising agency in Ireland. And he was also a sheep farmer. So, which is a very odd kind of combination. He was a salesman, he was an advertising person, and also a sheep farmer.
From Dublin?
Yes, from Dublin, even though he was actually brought up, you know, a little later by his granny in Granner, County Longford. So he's, and he's strong. He owned land and had sheep in Mayo as well. So he's kind of like
a Renaissance man.
Totally a Renaissance man, yes.
You know, he's...
He speaks about what you refer to there, and that was how himself and Marion met. And he is extraordinarily honest about that. Were you surprised, Kate, with how open and honest he was about that? Something that was quite personal to both of them.
I think we, you know, we talked about, you know, that we had to deal with that. And he knew, having, you know, been with Marion for 40 years, that these were questions you had to ask. And any, you know, there would be a glaring hole if you didn't ask these questions. So he was incredibly straightforward about it and open. And,
yeah.
And I think one of the things I think that even though this documentary is about John's grief, it is also very upbeat in terms of their life. And that was something that he felt very particular that he wanted to get in. He wanted it. They had a great life. And he wanted to get that part of Marion's personality and their life together in, I think, very strongly.
Usually when you would speak to you know, maybe a broadcaster or a journalist or a sports person, and you ask them who are your heroes or who inspired you, it's probably somebody in that field. But it wasn't the case, Patrick, with Marion. Her two great influences, as John talks so deeply about, were her dad and her school.
Yeah. I mean,
they are what shaped Marion, the Marion that we knew.
Yeah, I mean, the documentary in some other ways could be seen as an advertisement for Skull Katrina, the Irish-speaking Dominican school that used to be on Eccles Street and is now up actually quite close to where Marion comes from, Moby Road and Glasnevin.
Yeah.
And those nuns there had a huge impact on her in the sense that there was a head nun there, and that's the wrong term, who, I mean, from the first day they arrived in.
Probably was the Mother Superior back then, yeah.
Yeah, gave her a lecture on you're here to ask questions, which shocked Marion. She was, because in school, at that point, you were always told to kind of shut up, basically, mm-hmm. and listen. And, you know, they had a debating society there. They had an orchestra. Marion actually played the cello, which was something that I was completely unaware of. And then her father they're from North Cork, from the kind of Cork-Kerry-Limerick border, both of them actually, although her mother and father met in Dublin. And her father had been a member of the IRA. He joined the Gardaí, and he was an incredibly well-read man. He just devoured books, so much so that, you know, Marion's mother worried about the influences that the books were bringing into his head, like, and particularly when he became ill, he had a heart condition, which I think probably Marion also picked up with, you know, from a DNA point of view. But and he died when Marion was 12 years old. But in his last years, he, you know, as John says in the documentary, started reading the Bible, which Catholics in Ireland were not encouraged to
unaided.
Do. And, you know, he kind of quotes, you know, Marion's mother kind of saying, you know, Dan, if you keep reading that book, you're going to lose your immortal soul. And John said that made a big impression on Marion because she just thought, like, you know, read everything, particularly the books that people don't want you to read,
yeah.
You know.
And her dad as well told her to do something, Kate, which a lot of women back then, if they happened to be tall, would try to hide that. He said, walk tall.
Absolutely. That was, and she always did. Marion had this very gracious, tall walk, which is very distinctive, constantly, right up to the very end. One thing I did want to say is that the Finucan family have had a very hard year because not alone has Marion died, but two of her brothers died as well. So
Lord rest them.
Yeah. Her brother.
She was one of five.
She was one of five, and both her brothers died. So they're just two sisters left, Dorothy and Therese.
Noel
died just a week before Christmas. So
she had her brother living in Canada, is
yes,
that right?
Yes, that was Noel. Oh. And the other thing I wanted to say is that her family were incredibly helpful to us in trying to find photographs, and Noel's wife, Usha, in Canada was brilliant as well.
Well, there are some wonderful photos from different holidays, and this thing about, you speak there about John having the farming background, and they bought a farm when they got together, and when the two children were small, they bought a farm in Westmead from where Marion would commute, isn't that right, up to present Liveline. But he talks lovingly about the two adult children that would come down at the weekend, who were Nulo Phelan and
Nell
McCafferty, of course. And we have a clip here because Nulo obviously and Marion became very, very close. And in a similar sort of way to the way John is speaking now about Marion in her time before death and immediately afterwards, here is a famous interview. A loving interview, which a lot of our listeners remember last year, requested to hear part of again. And it's in the documentary, and it's obviously Nulo and Marion, which is in the documentary, as you said. But we've another clip here as well. And this is a very funny one. The Nulo interview was obviously very poignant and touching and all of that. But we're going to play now this one. And this is the famous Joe Jacob interview.
One of the things she did, which frightened, I think, politicians after a while, if a minister was coming in to talk about a new act he was going to pass or whatever, Marion read the whole act, not once, not twice, many times, and she read the small print. And if the minister hadn't done his homework, trouble.
Joe Jacob, who's junior minister with the Department of Public Enterprise, you are in charge of minding us, I understand, in a national emergency.
The Taoiseach has put in place immediately in the aftermath of the atrocity of the 11th of September. The Taoiseach put in place a coordinating committee involving a range of departments.
OK, so I got my message 7 minutes ago. What would have happened by now?
How will the information and advice be given to the public?
Yeah.
And Marion, your question and the answer to it will be on my fact sheet, which will be in every home in Ireland weeks from now.
But tell me now.
I will tell you now. All information will be issued immediately, Marion.
Yeah. Well, say it's a bad situation.
If it's a bad...
Say a plane crashed into Sellafield. Say the wind was blowing this way. And it all happened 8 minutes ago.
Yes.
What advice do we give to our citizens and what happens?
We would be talking about iodine tablets.
How do we get our iodine tablets?
No, that will be in the fact sheet when it gets to your home, okay?
No, but you, Marion, tell me, no, you have, no, the fact sheet,
Marion,
in front of you.
And perhaps
what does it say in the fact sheet?
I'll tell you precisely.
Now, it sounds as if Marion sitting there with her arms folded, having a chat, asking, you know, the questions as if she's just met Joe Jacob for the first time and has only heard 5 minutes beforehand about all of this. But that wouldn't have been the case, Patrick. There would have been an awful lot of work that would have gone into that interview. More, she put in a lot bigger effort than Joe Jacob did.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I noticed from the first time I started working with her is that, you know, Marion was incredibly cool on air, right? I mean, and some people misinterpreted that as being casual, not really caring that much and so on. But the fact of the matter is that she spent a lot of time doing her homework. And if Marion had a big fear when the red light went on, it was always that somehow or other there was something she might have missed, that she would somehow be caught out on air not knowing what the right question was or not having the right piece of information. That was her big fear, nothing else. And what gave her that coolness and that casual, like, sometimes she seemed like as if she could actually sleep on air. She was so comfortable. But that's what gave her that comfort level.
Was the meticulous preparation beforehand.
Yeah, and quite often in their kitchen, where herself and John Clark would be kicking the thing around endlessly and so on. So it was really, you know, he was very much part of her kitchen cabinet in that regard.
OK, I think we have a clip of John talking about all of that.
Also, there was the idea, you know, that institutions protect themselves, institutions tell lies, institutions spin stories.
This was not a shameful position to be in, Marion.
Well, then
this had
why
occurred.
Is every commentator, left, right and centre, saying that the Irish banks behaved imprudently, some would say recklessly,
yeah,
in the amount of money given and lent for property deals when the dogs in the street who don't own a house,
sure,
knew that the property market was going down.
And her view was, together, the public and I, will try and look at this.
OK, a couple of callers in. Now that the banker has said, thanks, can he go the whole hog and say sorry to the Irish people?
Marion, I can't say sorry with any type of sincerity and decency, but I do say a very genuine thank you, because that is right.
A lot of people used to say to me, you know, Marion always asked a question I really wanted to ask, you know, how did she figure that one out? I'd have to say, a lot of hard work, you know, is the answer.
There's a certain irony that we have been preached at about how let the market sort it out. And then when the marketeers get into difficulty, they go running to the government.
I mean, her guiding light, as a saying, was Dolly Parton. Dolly Parton says, it costs a lot of money to look this cheap. And Marion took the view, it costs a lot of homework to sound this relaxed.
And that was a clip from an interview with Sean Fitzpatrick of Anglo-Irish about 2007-2008. Many of us will remember it. So Marion came into this slot in, I think it was the mid-noughties, isn't that right?
05.
And at that stage, Saturdays were seen as a bit of the so-called graveyard shift on radio in terms of radio programmes. We had probably comedy programmes on, and then it was basically people listened to the radio on a Saturday for sport. But she transformed radio listening at the weekend. But was she happy about moving from daytime programmes to the weekends?
Not really. I mean, she, after Gay Byrne retired, Marion had been doing Liveline in the afternoon. And you got to remember, actually, just to go back a little bit, when Women Today started in 1979, there were sponsored programmes in the afternoon. There was no afternoon radio worth talking about. And Women Today created an audience in the afternoon, and then she switched to Liveline. And then Liveline built this extraordinary audience, over 400,000 people, in the afternoon when there had been none. And that resulted in more programming ending up. So we now have drive time and it all flows into the afternoon. So when Gay Byrne retired, that was his morning slot between 9 and 10 was considered to be the plum slot. And Marion was given that slot. And then, you know, after a few years, it's sort of like the word kind of came down that they needed somebody more light relief. As what John says in the documentary, he said they wanted more fun and texting, and Marion wasn't a citizen, as he put it, for fun and texting. So essentially, Marion felt that she was being pushed because she had reached a certain age. And she felt very strongly about the fact that women, when they reach a certain age in media, get the push. Men can kind of basically get very grey and kind of move on, you know, into an old age on air. So she was very upset, but she also had remembered that there was one of the bosses here who was somebody who was a real great mentor to us as well. Michael Littleton had once kind of been saying to her, the weekend is just, Irish society has changed. You know, so many women are out working during the week. The weekend is a just great unplowed area.
Yeah.
And so Marion decided that it's sort of one of those kind of expressions, when you're given lemons, make lemonade. So herself and one of her like longtime producers who was with Marion through thick and thin, Anne Farrell, went to the weekend and they just basically decided to do the kind of show they wanted to do on a Saturday and a Sunday. In other words, they did the kind of radio that they both wanted to do.
And the audience followed.
And the audience followed. And in a way, if you look at Saturday and Sunday now, the audience is like, was not there before. And Marion also, I mean, I always felt in RT, she never quite got the respect internally she deserved, because wherever she went, she built an audience. Mm-hmm. She never made a big deal about it. She just went and did it.
It's on Monday night. It's at 9:30 on RT One Television. And there is another aspect we're not going to get to now, but John talks very, very candidly and heartwarmingly about his late daughter, Sinead, something that Marion was more private about indeed. But we get an insight into the heartbreak that she went through and which stayed with her right until the end of her life, Kate.
Yeah, absolutely. Marion could never really talk about it without crying. So, you know, even when we were doing the Nuala Phelan documentary with her, I remember if Sinead's name came up without Marion having prepared herself for it, she would just burst into tears. So she never could talk about her in any way. But John talks about that very, very movingly, I think, in the documentary.
Well, we're going to finish with that clip where John talks about Sinead. They're only 8 years of age when she passed away. And as he said himself in the piece, if it was 10 years later, she would have been actually saved. And it's a very poignant part of what is a very striking, thought-provoking documentary shot through the eyes of John Clark, Marion Finucane's late husband. And Amanda wanted a party, Patrick, to celebrate Marion's life, but that will happen post-COVID.
He's hoping post-COVID will happen. And the other thing I wanted to throw in is that, like, the same team that basically made the Nuala Phelan documentary, including this extraordinary editor, Jordan Montminy, who's also a co-producer of the documentary, we kind of came together to do it. And we also got the assistance of an extraordinary young cinematographer,
Esme
McNamee, who his work is all over this film as well. So There's a lot of talent in this country.
A lot of talent. It wasn't just the both of you.
No,
and John is the star of it, if we can call it that. And
exactly.
Our condolences to John and the family. And one, just briefly before we go, a shining light is that he is a grandfather now to, and Marion would have been a grandmother 5 weeks after she died. Her granddaughter Sinead was born to their son John. Isn't that right?
Jack is right.
She was
okay. So looking forward to that.
All right. Okay. Listen, thank you both very much indeed. And a hopeful new year to you, as I'm saying this morning, to Kate O'Callaghan and to Patrick Farley. And here's John Clark.
The order of dying would be me first, and I was very happy with that idea, but it didn't work out that. You could say it's sad, but it's the order of things, you know. I've led a very lucky life, except the last Sinead and I lost Marion, but, you know, I had an easy life and a good life. Marion always said, you know, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans. And there's a huge truth in that, whether you believe in him or not.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.